if you don't have hope, it's hard to live and thrive in this place that we call America.
Welcome to the Social iPod. We're sociologists Winona,
Win,
and Michelle.
Talk with a variety of guests to explore complex relationships between the personal and the political.
Using sociology to explore big ideas.
We explore the taken for granted in everyday life, and we break down the complexity of institutionalized issues and inequality through lived experiences. Our guest with us for this episode is Miss Judy Hill. Welcome, Miss Judy. It is an honor to have you join us as our second ever guest on the Social iPod.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
Judy is a native of Oberlin, Ohio, and graduate of the University of Akron and Youngstown State University. Professionally, she worked for Akron Public Schools for 30-plus years, teaching, designing curriculum, and serving as an administrator. As a retiree, she is actively involved in the community and serves on a variety of committees and boards. Most notably, she is the president of the Akron chapter of the NAACP, a board member of Towpath Credit Union, and board chair of the newly formed Black Chamber of Summit County. Judy is also a Sunday school teacher at Arlington Church of God, a member of Christ Child Society of Akron, and a guardian ad litem for abused and neglected children in Summit County. She has received many honors and awards, including the University of Akron Alumni Award, Akron Urban League Pioneer Award, Women of Achievement Award, Harold K. Stubbs Award, the Catholic Commission Bishop Pilla Leadership Award, and a finalist for a Northeast Ohio Athena International Leadership Award. She feels her greatest honor is a grandmother to 10 and wife of Dr. Gregory Hill. So Judy, I have the fortune to get to experience your leadership as the president of the Akron chapter of the NAACP, and now I get to learn just how much you do beyond that position. One of the things that I didn't know before receiving your bio was that you were a teacher in Akron Public Schools for over 30 years. My first question for you is, how has your long career as an educator informed the work you do in the community?
First of all, thank you, as I said again, for the invitation. I was honored to be asked because I believe that knowledge is power, as the educator that I am. So I worked for Akron Public Schools for 30 years, but before I was an educator in the Akron Public Schools, I also provided instructional support for my brother who had a learning disability. And in order for him to graduate, and that was back in the day when they didn't have a lot of social services or support for students with learning disabilities. So every summer, when school was out, we would painstakingly work together. And I tutored him for his high school academic years, so that he could graduate and graduate on time. And so I've been an educator a very long time in my mind. And in Akron, I taught fourth grade. I taught sixth grade. I worked in curriculum. I worked in administration. And I also worked in what's called community partnerships. And so every one of those positions helped me in this role that I'm in today.
So beautiful. That's such an amazing story to hear. It sounds like you've done some community work along with your education, but what got you more broadly into community activism and that side of things? Can you tell us a little, like expand a little more on your community work?
Sure. First of all, I'm from Oberlin, Ohio. And if you're not familiar with Oberlin and its history, Oberlin was one of the first colleges to allow women, one of the first to allow African Americans. It was a major stop on the Underground Railroad. So if that hopefully helps you understand a part of who I am. During the time when I was in high school, I had a professor who was actually a student teacher who introduced me to the Black Panthers, who introduced me to some different socialist organizations. And it really was about, hey, you have this thirst to understand, let me expose you so that you have a broader depth of understanding. I was in awe of, first of all, as a high school senior, someone giving me that kind of knowledge and helping me to expand my thinking. And I know that laid the foundation for a lot of the work that I did. That's one. Also, two, my mother was a single mom. She was a single mom of seven children. My parents were divorced when I was young. And she never believed in welfare. She worked three jobs. And she took care of seven children and bought a home. So all of that, through that experience as well, we learned how to make do, support each other, support community members, because there are a lot of folks who didn't have a place to stay, but they always knew that they could come to our house and stay. It was amazing to watch how, in the day, people supported each other. It was neighborhood, it was family, it was really a sense of community. So between that and my work in living in Oberlin and the work that I do with the Akron area, yeah, it's almost like, how could I not? I remember there was an incident on our college campus where a young female, African-American female, was raped by a white male. And we really thought that he was going to get off. Well, the problem was she was ill and ended up passing away. And I'll never forget the activism that that incident sparked in me, because I saw the inequity in a different kind of way. I'm from Oberlin, so I didn't feel it in the same way as I did in this college town. Yeah, we were threatened that we were going to lose our scholarships, that we wouldn't be able to finish school. And the key was, do you fight for what you believe in, or do you give in to all the threats? Sounds familiar to this area where we're going through right now, this age in society. And we stayed the course. We stayed the course, and he was convicted. He didn't get the years that we thought he should, but we didn't get kicked out of school. All those were threats. We did march downtown. We did make sure that people understood in the community what was happening on that college campus, and that was important to me. Yeah. So just kind of laid that foundation of moving forward and doing.
Question. You were talking about like community and what it looked like, what it felt like back then. And obviously you're still very much so in community and doing community work now. Are there any notable differences between what it looked and felt like then versus now?
I think the notable difference is the maturity and understanding that I have. That's the biggest difference. I believe the issues were the same. I believe that the players were the same. The difference is now I understand it more and probably more frustrated. It's like we take two steps forward and one and a half back. And it seems like historically that's what we've done over and over again. It's like we don't live by what's considered human. It's by I call it the issue of the day. And people live their lives by the issue of the day instead of the humanism of this race we call human.
What would you say has been your perspective shift, if that's the most noticeable difference? How did you like think back then, and how is it different now?
I don't think my perspective has changed much. I remember when I was in, elementary or middle school, my sister always said to me, you always had this Pollyanna view of life. And I didn't know who Pollyanna was, but I didn't take it as a compliment. Later on in life, I understood that to mean I do. I always look at the glass half full instead of half empty. I do believe in the spirit of the human spirit. I definitely. And I think that's what she was referring to, instead of looking at the negativism and sometimes the way life really is. Historically, I think that has been my greatest learning, that historically we have done this over and over again, even biblically, folks. Let me get on my soapbox, okay? Because I...
Get on it.
It drives me crazy. You know, give us 20, 30 years, and it's like, dang it, we forget all about. what happened before, what got us to this point. But even in the Bible, over and over again, people would just go back to the way they used to be. And understanding that almost makes me feel hopeless, but it's not. I cannot believe that we can't do this. I have to believe we can do it. I'll never forget Cornel West came to the University of Akron as a speaker. And he made a statement that has always profound me. He said, when someone asked him about racism, he said, I'm not optimistic, but I'm hopeful. Now that for me, it was like, wait a minute, that doesn't work for me. Either you're both or you're neither. But I get it. If you don't have hope, it's hard to live and thrive in this place that we call America. Optimism is really looking at the state of where we are. So I get it now.
That's beautifully put. I think it's something that's been on my mind a lot personally, and something that I think has come up commonly in the sort of community organizing and political work I've done. It's like, how can one stay like motivated, stay feeling optimistic about the chances to win when the odds just seem so great? And it's like, there will be a moment of like a rupture of hope, of possibility, of even like radical transformative change, such as I think a lot of us experienced most recently in the summer of 2020, and at least in my neck of the woods. And then it seems like it evaporates and things move on.
It's almost like it never happened.
Right. So many different angles I want to riff off this with you. Something that stood out to me, though, is, you know, thinking of this two steps forward, one and a half steps back, how much we forget. For you, based off of your experience, what are some of the key takeaways that you would want to see carried forward? What do you want to see not forgotten based off your experience struggling all the way back since the the time of the Black Panthers and the other like socialist actors in the movement that you said that you were exposed to, from there to the present? What have you learned that you don't want to be forgotten, basically, by the generations that continue to carry this torch forward and continue to keep that hope alive, if not optimism?
It's probably different and a little unique. I believe, as a person of faith, that there is a creator that created all of us in our imperfection and in our being as humans. And in that creation, the only thing, the main thing that is required is that we love one another. Okay? And so everything I do, I try to base it around that. That's a charge as a human, that we help and love one another. And so that is one thing that I hope we never, ever, ever, ever let go. Another thing is this thing about erasing history. Jiminy criminy. That's scary. How can you can't reshape it. You can't change it. Why try to eliminate pieces and parts of our history? And so what I hope is that we don't. That we recognize what happened with slavery, that we recognize the impact of our behaviors towards one another, that we recognize that in all of that, it helps to make a better, just society for all of us, right? Everything you go through has purpose and meaning. We can't forget that. We may not like it all the time. I think about it like when, as a kid, you know how your parents would punish you? Like, they'd say, don't touch that because that you're going to get burned. You're going to get burned. And inevitably, somebody's going to touch that burner and they're going to get burned. But those around us, we watch the process and we say, no, don't want to do it. I don't want us to lose that. That yes, we did get burned. And yes, that things have happened that they're not pleasant. It wasn't designed to be pleasant all the time, I don't believe. And so those are the kinds of things, and I know I've gone probably too philosophical on this, but for me, those are two things that I don't want us to forget, that we are designed to support. No man is an island. Support and love one another, that history is real, and that we can either learn from it or continue to make the same mistakes. And also that we still have a lot left to learn. And it's learning new things is not a bad thing. It's what we do.
110% every step of the way.
I don't know if that was where you wanted me to go, but
and if I could ask a question just based on what you were just saying, Judy, about being a person of faith, I want to ask what you think about others using their faith to excuse bad behavior or to harm other people. Because especially within the LGBTQ plus community, there's a lot of religious trauma because of that. And so how do you make sense of that? What do you think about it? Wherever you want to go with that question.
You know, biblically, it says sin is sin is sin. So it's so interesting that someone wants to call out someone else as sinning when the lies and the cheating and the stealing and the having affairs and all of that is a sin. So be careful when you point your finger, because you still have four coming back to you, right? Or three still pointing at you, your thumb still up in the air, like, what the hell? But bottom line, we all have fallen short. So it's so interesting that somebody wants to say someone else is not doing it right. And I think as we live through this life, we find out that there's this very thin definition of what is right and wrong. And people change. And that goes back to what I said earlier. It's like the flavor of the day. Instead of us starting and ending with the fact that we are all human, and where that gets lost in the shuffle is what scares me. To hurt someone because of their skin color, to hurt someone because of who they love, to hurt someone because of, and none of that has to do with interfering with another person's right to do something. Think about it. My skin color has nothing to do with your living your life. Who someone chooses to love or sleep with has nothing to do with the other person's right to live and drive down the street. We want to pick and choose what makes us feel superior, as opposed to looking at ourselves. It's very interesting to me. Fix you, damn it. Fix you. And then talk about fixing me. And when you become perfect, then you can do that. And that's really the way I feel about it. No one has that, in my opinion, that right. Not here. Not in this place that we call Earth. We just don't have that right. And so it's really frustrating to see. I am always puzzled by people who have been victimized, who want to victimize other folk. That freaks me the hell out. I think about women who were victimized for not being allowed to vote, not given the right to have a voice, who were victimized, who now want to victimize someone else. I take offense to people who, as African Americans who were victimized, who want to victimize others because of their sexual preference. It bothers my soul. And so the only way I know how to do anything about it is by looking at me. And that's where I start. That's why, like in Akron with our NAACP, when we talked about having an LGBTQ committee, I was like, look at our mission. Our mission is about equity. It's about education and security, social inclusion. What part of that's missing? Why would anyone not do it? And I think that's what bothers me. It's like, either you stand free of a mission or you don't. But, you know, folks want to go off their little single issue and want to just destroy because of that single issue. And I struggle with that. So I work on me.
It feels refreshing to hear you talk about your position. There's like a sense of humility and like, I don't know, some, all these like elements of what make, I think, a good leader, a good community leader of, you know, your perspective is just one that is inviting. And what's the word? It's solidarity, right? It's going across lines of identity to say, to find our, what is common to us.
But it's also about, as I said, about being human. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I went to a conference when I worked for Akron Public Schools, and one of the things that I feel most proud of is when I worked for the school district, they sent me to a lot of trainings and conferences, and I learned a great deal, and the goal was for me to come back and to teach other teachers, and, you know, there's a cadre of us who did that. Well, early in the LGBTQ movement, we were in San Francisco, I want to say, someplace in California. We were at this meeting, and, you know, we're sitting in this circle, and we're having these great conversation and this dialogue, and someone decided to share and say, you know what, I'm gay, and this is the way life is, and, you know, I'm tired of being treated a certain way, and they said, Judy, you get it. Now, first of all, why pull me into your conversation? Number two, I'm the only African American in the room. And so I thought, see, I try to be nice, but I had to help him understand. Nobody knew you were gay until you opened your mouth and told them. With me, look at me. Is there anybody here that doesn't know I'm African American? And so my blackness walks into the room before anything else. Before you know about who I am, what I stand for. Whereas with you, when you told us, then we all looked like, oh, okay. And what are we supposed to do with this information now? Because nobody asked me who I slept with. Nobody really cared. So it's like, you know, it's like we have to help each other understand life better. But that was a learning for him as well as for me. Because afterwards we talked. I didn't mean to make him cry. I was like trying to help him understand. You own your conversation. You own it. You don't put it on someone else. But clearly, everybody knew I was black when I walked in the room. Nobody knew he was gay until he said something. Yeah. And so it was like, help. Let's help each other just be ourselves and live in our truth. And see how we can move and progress and do better in this world together.
Yeah. That maybe that kind of gets into this question of what are your biggest challenges and privileges of the work that you've done?
You know, I saw that question on your list and I chuckled. I told my husband the answer is still the same. Someone else asked me that. My biggest challenge is people. And it's also my greatest privilege. I have seen some absolutely, in dialogue with some absolutely crazy people, crazy in their ideas to me, right? In Akron, we went through this process of having Afrocentric schools. And under my my purview, I said, let's open it up to the community to call in, ask us questions. People are like, you don't want to do that. Oh, my God. Blah, blah, blah. No, I want to hear, but I want them to listen, too. And that was my only caveat. If you call me, I'm going to listen to you, but then I want you to listen to me. It's amazing, the conversations and the things people said to me. But when we got off the phone, probably 80% of the time, it was, oh, what do you have to call it that? And I thought, isn't that interesting? It's all about educating and educating children. And when you help a subgroup, you're really helping everybody. And when people understand that, whether it's we're talking about African Americans or gay or whatever, we're helping all of us elevate because it helps the community. When one thrives, all of us thrive, right? But 80% of the time, people were like, do you have to call it Afrocentric? And that goes to their racism. That didn't go to the issue at hand, which was educating all children. It's very interesting. That was, if I really wanted to write be a doctoral student, I would have written about that experience.
Hey, there's still time.
I'm on the other end. No. I'm on the other side of that. Yeah, some of those learnings I think were for me as I continue to grow in who I am.
Yeah, I really appreciate the common theme throughout. Like in each of these questions, you have been clear to recenter our shared humanity and our common interests and our common goals in the fact that, like, I don't know, I'm thinking of common movement slogans like liberation for one is liberation for all, right? Like, we all have ultimately common cause and skin in this game. And I think, you know, at least speaking only for my own perspective and opinion, common enemies in the form of, like, the systems that oppress us. That's at least been a useful framing for me. And I also appreciate the holding space for, even within that, like, common cause and that shared humanity, there's still room to have these conversations about important nuances and important differences, as you've mentioned, like, the different ways that one can experience discrimination or oppression based on racism or based off of homophobia, right? Or the way that I experience, transphobia as a white trans woman in Utah is going to be very different than a trans woman of color in Ohio, I'm sure, right?
Utah.
And like, sorry. yeah, it's great. and here's a great opportunity for me to say that I am legally required to say that I am speaking only for myself and not my employer, right?
That's
which
right.
I'm placing here in the conversation for no rhetorical effect whatsoever, right? Anyways, I was trying to come up with a question to riff off that on the fly, but I think it really resonates, and I really appreciate how you approach it and how you speak to it and how you weave that through the experiences that you've shared with us and your takeaways.
But, you know, it's also important to recognize we bring all of our self to the table every time we do or say something, right? All of my background, it didn't come from, you know, in a little community like Oberlin, like the people that we knew were gay, it was like one or two of whatever. But it still was about us treating each other a certain way. It had nothing to do with that. But you never leave you at the table.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? You can't just leave it over here and then go someplace. So I had my biases and I have my issues as well, right? And the beauty of having these kind of conversations is that there are people that they know my heart, and they know when I say, or we have conversations, I'm like, I don't get the he, her, them. That I said, I'm Judy. I'm not going to do that. And they'll laugh at me, but they get it, right? Because I still am who I am. I can't let that go. That doesn't mean I love you any less. It just means that's just a piece of the puzzle I just can't do. I'm just Judy. So I don't put anything by my, you know what I mean? So it's things like that you can have conversation like this and be honest. If somebody can say, well, Judy, you're full of shit. Or they can say, oh, you know what? It's okay, Judy. Or, you know what? We do it this way because. And then I can hear and understand it from the right voice, not from the noise that you hear in social media or et cetera. There's power in that. And so that's the other reason why I said I would do this, because I think it's so important that people hear honest dialogue. I get so sick of those canned expressions and canned conversations. I want to say, you're a lie. You don't believe that. Your face is saying something totally different, right? And so let's just be honest with one another and move on. It's like I can disagree and agree with the fact that, okay, that's the way you feel, and this is the way I feel, and it's okay. If that makes sense. And I was saying that to what you were referencing, but it's like it really has to be honest for it to move forward.
100%. 100%. And it's amazing. You speak to the power of these sorts of conversations. It's amazing what can be accomplished. It's, let's say, like, in finding connection with other one another, in building community in a real way, and in, like, working together in the interest of our shared humanity for more freedom for all, let's say, just through, like, a real conversation, right?
A real conversation. Absolutely. Yeah. I remember going to New York and hanging out with some friends, and this guy was, he told me he was gay, and I was like, damn, you're so good looking, I can't believe you're gay. And we're laughing and joking about it and drinking. I'm just being honest with you. And we kept going. You know, it wasn't anything negative. It wasn't meant to be. It was like, and we just laughed about it because he was gorgeous. And I was like, darn. But that's okay. We can still enjoy each other's company. So it's just about being honest with one another and recognizing that honesty can be a wonderful tool. Mm-hmm. And for some folks, because they're cruel, honesty can also be a weapon. And I don't see it as a weapon. I see it as an opportunity for us to move closer together. I think one of you said it about us moving in the same direction, better together.
Your like little anecdote there, in the most beautiful way, is reminiscent of something like exactly my grandma has said, like of her many tales. But that also, as we were talking about honesty and having real dialogue with people, I think of instances teaching where I've had students, and usually it'll be like the most privileged of students that we can conjure up in our mind, right? So like a cis white hetero man taking my class, and there was one instance in particular at the end of the semester, and he was writing, I think I asked for, like, you know, feedback or how did you enjoy the class, that kind of thing. And the way he worded it was kind of funny, but the sentiment was powerful, where he was like, essentially he had never met a non-binary person before. And he was like, at first, I didn't believe in you people. But now, you know, like, with the exposure and just being able to be in contact and be learning together, that he was like, okay, non-binary people exist. And, like, here's an actual human example of a non-binary person that now I've gotten to meet, right? And my class today even was talking about like the power of exposure to different types of people and different ways of living. But that's all to say, you were give us a good segue to my next question, which is, how do you handle conflict when it inevitably arises in community? You said you're biggest challenge and biggest privilege is humans and working with other people, and that's where conflict comes from. So yeah, if you have any, like, I suppose, like, tips, or what is handling conflict like for you when it arises?
I've had some wonderful mentors that I've learned from, because as my husband says, I can be kind of quick-tempered when somebody goes awry. But I think the biggest thing is to learn to listen. Because sometimes the words that you hear are not necessarily what they're trying to say. And trying to get to what the real question is. Because it's easy to respond in the middle of a crisis without the facts. And for some people, they dislike that about the way I deal with some of the issues, especially that happen in our city. I'm going to listen first. I want to know the facts. I want to make sure that when I say something, I'm responding to truth and not just somebody telling me some opinion, because we get in trouble a lot by that. My grandkids are quick to say, you didn't even let me finish. And that's my reminder that I got to let you finish so that I have better understanding. And they hate when I use them as examples, but yeah, I did it to their
mom.
Hi,
grandkids.
you know. Yeah, I did. But yeah, it's really about listening first. And then when I respond, fortunately and unfortunately, people hear my heart as well as my discontent around the issue. And that can be a plus and a minus, because some people are like, oh, take emotion out of it. I can't take emotion out of you killing a man that did nothing. I can't take emotion out of you hurting someone just to hurt them. Sorry, it's an emotional thing. Yeah, and I don't know how to do it any other way. And I think that's the way he made me, and so I'm going to go with it. But, yeah, I definitely try to listen first and not fly off the handle. But I also try not to own somebody else's issue. And that's been a new learning for me. There are times that, let's say, in our police community interactions, police officer or someone may say, oh, you know what, we've had this issue before and this is what, okay, but that's your problem. We're talking about this issue right now and how we're dealing with this issue. And that makes people so angry. They want to make it like, oh, if everything is a big, no, it's not a big cultural issue. This issue is you don't know how to communicate. And if you learned how to communicate better, you wouldn't have half the problems that you have. Does that take away from the fact that you're going to have issues? No. But if you freaking learn how to communicate with folk, you'll do a better job. So it's about really listening and trying to find that middle ground. I really do. And it doesn't always happen.
I know.
I try.
At least in my worldly observations, something that is very common in our culture now, especially like on the left, right, within leftist communities or liberal communities, there is a tendency to just quickly write people off and almost like, in a way, dehumanize them because they've done a wrong. And then, right, that's the whole basis of cancel culture, where we're like, okay, you did something wrong, I'm not messing with you anymore, and like, go on. But then that, it doesn't help anything, right? And so, like, meeting someone, trying to meet someone where they are, and when that's possible, that's a good reminder.
Because you're right, when it's possible, because it's not always. There are times people don't want to hear. They just want to be heard. And sometimes what they're spouting is so, the rhetoric is so stupid. But I do try to, as my mother used to say, let them bury themselves. You keep talking long enough, you'll bury yourself. I don't have to do it. I don't have to do a thing, because you're just going to go down the road. I saw a superintendent in Akron do that. Just as an example, we were talking about racial issues, and he said something so racist in front of the whole board and everyone else, and I thought, drop the mic. I don't have to say a word. You just buried yourself. And it was very telling. Allow them to be them, and then you can help refocus folks back on what's true and right and just.
It's funny, I think a takeaway for me, whether it's been work in movements or work in the classroom or what have you, is that you can't teach someone who doesn't want to be taught. You can't be heard by someone who doesn't want to listen. And it's a reminder for myself and turn to be humble and to always be working on listening as an act, like practice and kind. You know?
Yes, yeah. And you know what I've also learned is that people say they're not listening, but they are. They don't want to admit it. They don't want to acknowledge it in front of others, but they hear. Yeah, yeah. I've been in awe of that and watch people come back and say, you know, you said, and I thought, oh gosh, here we go. But then they recognize some truths and the middle ground that I was talking about.
Sometimes the language that people use isn't actually what they mean, or that when they're taking rhetoric from somewhere else and using it, right, without fully, maybe fully meaning it or fully understanding the repercussions or what have you. I think something that is beautiful, I guess, connected back to the shared humanity is that there are so many different types of words, and now the meaning that are put to certain words can really be a barrier between people understanding each other and their shared humanity. And so there's a lot of, I mean, especially in like community work, a lot of sometimes translation that has to happen, or trying to be more, I guess, impeccable with your word, if you will, or like trying to say exactly what you mean rather than just picking up on words that you've heard and trying to regurgitate them for whatever.
Yeah, which goes back to what you said about the person who said, hey, I didn't know anybody like you. And what he was saying was, all that shit I heard, it's not all true, right? And so you can't negate it until you are faced with realities of it, right? And sometimes reality slaps us in the face. And when it slaps us in the face, it's hard for people to say anything and admit that they were wrong. But give them a moment to go back and
think. And to give the grace to let people do that too.
That consciousness.
Even when you don't want to give them that.
Yes. Yeah. You know, sometimes in this work, there are people who will call and they'll ask us to assist them in areas that really they know that we can't. But then they'll try to blame it on us. Well, then what do you do? Blah, blah, blah. And there are some triggers, you know, on the back of my neck that I try to keep them back there. But dang, when they go down those roads, then I go, and I try not to do that. I really do. But it does happen. I'm human. And I haven't been the best communicator in those situations. Because then I am just like the person that put them in the situation where they are with me. And I try not to be that person. But the greatest challenge is my greatest privilege.
So that aspect is part of our shared humanity as well. Like, I am so mad so much of the time, and it can be hard to keep that in check. If someone's saying the wrong shit.
Yes, exactly. And you don't want to, but it's like, I can't believe you just said that out loud, right? Mm-hmm. And you want to... Mm-hmm. So I might go that far, but I don't want to take it all the way. People know, you know, it takes a lot to get me there, but when I'm there... Look out, because you're going to get all the truth. No holes barred.
Well, that's part of it, too.
I personally admire that, because that's when maybe sometimes I know realize that it's not as constructive as can be, but I prefer that and getting all that brutal honesty rather than, like, sometimes, and I think why I admire it is because part of my humanity is, like, when people say their inside thing out loud, my brain, like, short circuits, and I'm like, what? Like, that's real? People really think that? And I go on the fritz. And so other people who are, like, ready to shut it down, I'm like, praise that.
I wanted to say something about, like, I feel like a part of what each of you were, like, talking about. There's, like, an element of, like, there's the idea that part of one of the elements of white supremacy is perfectionism. Is this expectation for perfectionism. Mm. And I feel like it's this like cultural thing that we have internalized. So it makes it hard to, again, accept that your reality is like your perception is imperfect, right? When you get new information in, there's like this, you have to accept, like admit that you're wrong and that you're not perfect. And so I feel like there's that like peace, whereas Judy, as you've talked about, like your work, such a big part of your work is embracing imperfection and embracing the imperfection of other people.
Wow. I'm gonna steal that from you, by the way. Wow. You've given me something to think about.
Carrying another thread forward, I think. Thinking of your example, Michelle, thinking of a lot of these examples, a lot of the examples you brought up, Judy, as well, is that, like, there's so much noise, right? Especially today. I mean, it's cliche to say something, social media, something, like, there's always been propaganda, right? But I think something I've always been, I have long banged my head against the wall moving in, like, liberal or, like, more progressive or left spaces is, with an emphasis on identity and identity politics, there's such an emphasis on what divides us. Or if you are, you know, say, a young man growing up today and you get sucked into the manosphere channels like we talked about on our last episode, you know, maybe you've learned something that taught you that non-binary people aren't real, right? And then it's like, if one is able to make the space for the sort of conversations we've been talking about, like, our shared humanity is not only something that defines us, like, fundamentally and provides with us, like, a shared interest in each other's future, but it, like, if you're actually in the room with someone and you're actually willing to have that real conversation with grace, it smacks you in the face and can prove so much of that bullshit true. Whether it's the focus on differences that can divide us and undermine solidarity, or it's outright reactionary perspectives, but that do that to a much further degree. I don't know.
You know, it's interesting because you just made me think about some of our meetings and places where I'm at, and people will say they don't like a comment because that person is blah, blah, blah. And it isn't that. It is, they disagree with the person, and it has nothing to do with the fact that I'm black. It has nothing to do with the fact, but it's easier to pick on that thing. Oh, she is a black woman. She don't know what she's talking about. Okay. The issue is, you don't want to be wrong. You don't want for others to know that I could be right about this issue, and it has nothing to do with my color, right? Yeah, yeah. My daughter taught me a very, see, there I go again, big lesson about that when she was in maybe middle school. I came home one day, and she and her friends were all sitting around, chilling, having a good time. But a couple of them had their feet up on my furniture. And I thought, oh, let me stop this. I said, you know, girl, we ain't white. We don't put our feet up on our furniture like that. And my daughter said to me in her wisdom, oh, Miss Multicultural Education. And I was like, wow, what a lesson for me, right? My issue wasn't whether you're black or white. It wasn't a cultural thing. It was, damn it, we don't put our feet up on our furniture. And it was such a huge lesson for me. And that's what when I said about starting with myself, that's what we have to do. We have to really look at what we say and what we do. And is it real to what we say we believe in? It's a very interesting process. But that one was a real learning experience for me. She hates when I tell that story. But it was so valuable to me. Because it wasn't that I didn't like her white friends that were there. It was like, damn it, we don't put our foot up on our furniture. No! Get them off! But to put color and race into it, she was like, oh. And just a little nugget. She knew she couldn't get too smart aleck with me. You know, I won't play that. but I got the message.
Perfect segue to our last question, especially as we're coming up on time here. It's about family. So perfect. From your bio, we can see that family is very important to you, being a grandmother to 10, a mother, and a wife. Our question is, how have you managed to do such emotionally taxing work while also caring for yourself and your family?
I believe that what good am I if I try to save the world and I'm not there for my family? So family is very important to me. We do things like we just came back from a family vacation. And we took 7 of the 10 grandchildren on vacation. Now that's not really a vacation for me, but it's so valuable. Because we're trapped in a car together for 4 or 5 hours, and we have to talk, and we have to interact, and you get to know each other in a way that you can on the phone in 2 minutes. Oh, Grandma or Nana, I got to do this, you know, and they're gone. Or they tell me what they need, and they're gone. They were trapped with us for 4 days. And the wonderful things that we learned about each other is pretty powerful. And so doing those kinds of things, we eat together as a family. Every Sunday we have Sunday dinner. And it's dinner and no devices. We go to church together. We try to do things together. I think them understanding that my work is about all of us. It's not just about, you know, the people that they hear about. I think it's important. Yeah. So just trying to really be a part of that family unit, because that actually helps take me away from all this toughness. People are like, how do you stand it? I was like, oh, sometimes you have to put it in the box and leave it in the desk.
Yeah, huge lesson for me. I can struggle with that last part.
You have to. And find something for yourself.
Mm.
People don't believe how important it is. Now I understand why CEOs and people that have really taxing jobs do extreme sports. Because you have to go completely away from whatever it is that you're working on. I mean, completely. I love to golf, but if I try to answer the phone, the game is already just okay. It gets worse if I try to do that. Yeah. So, you know, I get it now. I used to think those folks are crazy. What would make you want to do that? Why? Because it's something you have to just totally remove yourself from the craziness of the world.
And so it sounds like to me that, like, having family, having such a rich family life is, like, it's not something that, I mean, maybe it is, right? But ultimately for you, it's not something that's in tension with your work life over the years and all the things you've done with it. But it's, you know, they serve each other, they feed each other, they strengthen each other.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. But that's the way my whole life has been. I'm from a family of seven, and it was a strong unit. And so I learned that sense of family first. And family shapes the work. Like, if that makes sense, because I see it all as family. It's just a different family.
Yeah, very beautiful. I have learned so much from you, Judy, and it's kind of interesting and exciting to hear about, like, Oberlin and just, like, this, like, culture that is there and just how this is, like, the exciting thing of, like, when you do get, when you go out of your way to have conversations with people that you don't know, you learn so much about places and people and just, like, this good work that's being done elsewhere. It's just beautiful.
Absolutely. That's beautiful.
Yeah, I guess as we're wrapping up too, that makes me think of something that I've been thinking as we've been going on. It's really interesting, the specifically in Akron, the reputation that the city has, if you even know it, right? Like, I didn't know Akron before moving over to Ohio from the West, but it does have some negative connotation to it, and a lot of it is definitely racially coded, and a lot of it is just, like, casting it off, right, instead of, like, having compassion and care and wanting to understand what's going on and all of that. And I'm glad that, Judy, we've had you on today, especially as the president of the Akron chapter of the NAACP, and I think it is a very good just representation of the incredible work that is happening in Akron and the community that is in Akron that I've been lucky enough to come into.
I totally agree. Akron is not what people think. It has more possibilities than, I think, negatives. And if they're not sure, I could take them to a couple places in Ohio and others where then they could see the difference. Got a lot more going on than, yeah.
As a girly from out west, you're just making me that much more excited to inevitably visit.
Well, you guys, thank you very much. I truly enjoy the conversation, and thank you for helping me understand that I embrace imperfections. I'm just going to keep pondering that, and I'm going to write about that one. We have a podcast here that we do with the NAACP, and that's one that I'm gonna talk about more.
Beautiful.
So thank you.
Love
Beautiful.
That. I love that.
Can't wait to listen. I can't wait to read
this. Oh, thank you so much, Judy, for chatting with us today. It's been even more wonderful than I could have anticipated.
Such a pleasure.
Well, thank you guys very, very much. And I learned a couple things also, audio-wise. So.
Yay!
Okay. Yeah. All right. Thank you guys very much.
Thank you, Judy.
Thank you so much, Judy. So good to meet you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening.
Yeah.